Oh, from a production point of view, no, it's a nightmare. Absolute nightmare. It makes brilliant spirit, but you've got to work hard for it. So we've got an awful lot of steps. If you've got a Fitbit and you want to get your steps in, we're the distillery for you.
We are Miriam,
Martin,
and Manuel. We love Scotland, travelling and whisky.
On our trips, we talk to the people to bring their stories to you and to share our love for the water of life.
This is Inside Whiskey, the Barrel Talk. Today, we're in Speyside, between Grandtown on Spey and Aberlour, just in the middle, basically, between the two. And we're joined by Oliver Chilton, who is the head blender at Elixir Distillers and more recently, also in charge, managing director, I think, of Tormore Distillery. So welcome to the podcast, Oliver.
Oh, definitely not managing director. I mean, resident and barely put up with by the people who run the distillery. I'm just a wee blender, not anything fancier.
Just a wee blender. But before we talk about all the whiskey stuff, you told us that tomorrow you're going to do what all good parents are doing on a Sunday, shouting at your son from the sideline of the football pitch. So who is more motivated for the game tomorrow, you or your son?
Probably hopefully the coach, to be honest. They do take it quite seriously up here, even at the age of 8. So yeah, you have to shout, otherwise other parents look at you. You get judged. Yeah, if you don't get fully involved.
Yeah. You don't care about your kid.
Yeah, you don't care enough unless you're shouting, possibly right. Even swearing.
And then is your sideline advice, is it more the emotional kind or is it more like full tactical?
Oh, no, it's very technical. It's all no, you did that completely wrong. I'm a terrible parent in the sense that it's always, you know, you could have done that better, which I probably need to tone down. Talk more about the positives. His coaches are really good at the positives.
So thankfully, we're not talking about parenting skills on the podcast, but about you and whiskey. So let's talk about yourself. Your way into the whiskey industry was a little bit, I'd say, uncommon, maybe. Can you tell us about it? What was your first job in the whiskey industry?
It was in a shop. I don't know if it's uncommon, but it's probably uncommon to end up doing what I'm doing. So I started in a whiskey shop. Around 2004, 2005, in York, I was at university studying philosophy. And if anything drives you to drink, it's studying philosophy. So once you've read enough Immanuel Kant, you have to drink. It's the only thing left. So I found it a lot cheaper to work in a whiskey shop than buy from one. And I worked through retail for about 7, 8, 9 years. Ending up at the Whiskey Exchange in London Bridge. So I say there's loads of people who end up going for retail. I just don't think most of them end up living at, well, certainly
but
at Tormore.
Didn't you sell coffee before you sold whiskey? Didn't I read something like that?
That is a Billy Abbott digging into my past thing. Yeah, my first job at university was as a barista in a Starbucks, and that was opposite the whiskey shop. And I found it very advantageous to offer free coffee to the manager in exchange for whiskey.
What does Starbucks say if you offer free coffee?
No idea. I don't work for them anymore. I'm quite happy that they found out now that I gave away so much coffee in return for alcohol, which I may or may not have drunk on their premises. But it was... it worked really well for me, and it was a great route in because you got to learn so much. So the team who ran that shop at the time, two of which are still two of my closest friends, one of which runs a distillery in Yorkshire, and the other one works in spirit production in America. They taught me tons about whiskey. So it was a great, great place to learn because you were selling hundreds of different things. So you had to learn pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like a very good deal, coffee for whiskey, kind of.
I'd always give the coffee away and take the whiskey. I don't drink coffee. So.
Well, same for
oh,
me.
Oh, breaking so. My heart. That cupboard is just full of coffee. So.
Sorry. No, but then you already mentioned you basically started working for the Whiskey Exchange. And how did your career go on from there?
So I started in our shop in 2011, and started as a part-timer, I think Wednesdays and Sundays, which 2 weeks later turned into like 100 hours a week. pretty standard London terms of business. And from there, I ended up looking after a lot of the events, running Whiskey Show. And back then, we were a really small team. There were maybe 35, 40 people across the whole business at Whiskey Exchange. So it wasn't a massive company. And you kind of all end up pitching in quite a bit. So I ended up by about end of 2012, I was looking after the cask buying, single cask buying for Whiskey Exchange. And that led me into what at the time was specialty drinks, international sales, and then ended up being Elixir Distillers. But it was small. I mean, we were a hobby. We were a part-time business on the side of everything we did.
On the side of the 100 hours.
Yeah, so I always laugh. Back when I went to head office and I started doing kind of this side of the business, you'd come in December, and the standard day would be coming in at 9, doing your emails. In my case, going through stock sheets, looking for stock and casks, organizing bottlings. And then you get to about halfway through the day and you'd start picking up the phone to customers for Christmas sales. And then you get to about 3:30 and you'd go downstairs and you'd pick, pack and dispatch. And that was how it ran for quite a long time. But you got to see every part of the business, which was good fun.
All right. So then you basically really know what you're doing. And during your time at the Whiskey Exchange and now at Elixir Distillers, you definitely got to know Sukhinder Singh, who is the owner. What is it like to work with someone like him? Because he's really engaged when it comes to whiskey, right?
He is very engaged. Certainly, I mean, I find it really hard. I work with Sukhinder, and I've learned a lot from Sukhinder. He's definitely one of the most influential people in my life, not just in whiskey. He's also one of my best friends. The issues with Sukhinder tend to revolve around the hangovers and my wife shouting out from her. I used to live in Chiswick in a flat, and my wife could lean out the window and shout at us at 3 a.m. when we came home in a taxi. So there was a lot of that. There was a lot of fun. The main thing was generosity. You know, I learned more about old whiskey and process and how things were made just by drinking old whiskey, things I would never have had a chance to try in normal life. And none of it was done with any other reason than Sukhinder wanted to share what he was interested in. Mm-hmm. So, you know, genuinely very, very lucky to work with him, learned a lot. Today, he comes up with a lot of interesting ideas, so there's always something new to do. We always have to learn something new. It's always an adventure. It's good. It's a very... we have a really kind of, it's a nice family business. Everyone kind of gets a say to a degree.
Right, that's lovely. Absolutely. Yeah. And whiskey is so much about sharing always. And it's so, so good to see that it works on all levels, basically. It's cool.
And you were talking about your job, like choosing casks and organizing bottlings for the events or also the single malts of Scotland. And then you added the elements of Islay and Port Eskaig to Elixir Distillers portfolio. So what was the new addition coming there? What was going on in terms of work changing, maybe?
So from my side, so Elements of Islay was created before I started. It was created in 2008. And Port Eskaig was created in 2009. And when I joined the company, certainly on that side of the business, when I moved into single casks, most of my job revolved around single casks for the Whiskey Exchange, mm-hmm. buying direct from distillers, mm-hmm. in their livery, and then eventually into single malts of Scotland and into stuff for Whiskey Show. Those whiskies or those brands came in because, frankly, the person who was looking after left our business. It was my first opportunity to do blending, and that started with Elements of Islay. So the very first product I ever made was LP4, I think. Elements of Islay, LP4, BW3, and I want to say there was a BN, but I'm not entirely sure. and AR3. And they were really small batches. We would only work on 3-4 casks at a time, 5 casks at a time. So it was a really great place to learn because everything's quite small. Mm-hmm. it's difficult to hide. So if you make a mistake, it shows up really quickly. But a great place to learn, a great place to learn about wood, because we were doing a lot of re-racking back then, particularly for Elements of Isla. We were buying lots of stock for Port Askeg, where the wood quality wasn't maybe what we wanted. So we were learning lots about working with different cooperages. And we've taken all that learning into what we do now.
Mm-hmm. And you just mentioned your way into blending. So did that just happen through that, or were there more experiences how you got into blending?
I mean, the first experience was my wedding. So it was a bit of a bit of a...
Your wedding.
Yeah, a bit of an odd start. So I used to live just down the road from the Compass Box head office. And Greg Glass, who was there at the time, lived just down the road from me, John. And they invited us as the Whiskey Exchange to do some... I do a blending school at the office. Mm-hmm. And I went down because my wife and I lived just down the road, my then girlfriend, now wife. They said, oh, bring Laura. Chris Mabin, who I worked with here for quite a few years, he worked there at the time. He knew Laura quite well. He said, come down, you'll have a great time. And we got to the end of the tasting. We just got engaged. And I said, could we make a blend for my wedding? And Greg went, yeah. How much do you want? I said, I don't know, 10 liters. So we made a 10-liter blend. I think at the time it was the smallest ever blend that Compass Box had done. Greg used to drop samples through my door. So I'd come home to 10 CL samples of different blends or components, and then I'd go down to the office and we wax dipped all the bottles in the backyard of Compass Box HQ.
And your wife likes whiskey?
She does. Yeah, she wasn't.
That's good.
That's helpful.
She wasn't massively impressed with my idea of doing a whiskey tasting in the middle of our wedding. but we got past it. But yeah, no, we got engaged at Bemore Distillery. Whiskey's been a part of our life since we met. It's how we met. But that was the first, that's my first blending experience. And then I've had lots of other little things where I've learned more as we've gone on. I was very lucky. I got to do a session with Jim Beveridge through Sekinder. So I got to learn a bit from Jim and what they do at Diageo. And then over the years, I've been, the great thing about Scotch whisky and the whisky industry generally is if you ask questions, people will answer them. Mm-hmm. People will give you help. So, whether it's spending time with people like Sandy Hislop from Chivas when we bought Tullamore and asking those questions. Mm-hmm. Alan Winchester lives locally to us. And I've known Alan quite a few years, and he's someone I can phone up and just ask questions all the time for production. So it's a really open book.
That's amazing. Yeah. And still about the wedding, what did the whiskey turn out to be? Do you still remember what kind of whiskey was it? What did you go for?
I've got half a bottle next door. it's a full blend. So it's malt and grain. The grain component is quite old. It's 70s Invergordon.
Oh, wow.
But the malt component, the brief was that my dad was a massive Balvenie Doublewood fan.
Okay.
And so the brief was to stay in that kind of honeyed, kind of mm-hmm. Balvenie-esque place. And then we had a tiny bit of smoke because I liked peaty stuff, but it had to be approachable. It's aging really well. Like in the bottle, I've still got a few bottles left, little half bottles. I did lots of half bottles so I could keep them. I've got one open next door.
Right. Sounds like good fun. Definitely good fun. And then just for a general understanding, like we do have a general understanding of how blending works concept-wise, but how exactly do you do it when you're looking for something very specific? How do you choose lead malts? How do you choose extra components? How do you measure how much of each you need? How do you do that?
What do you start with? Do you start with the idea? And then how do you approach, this whole topic?
Always start with an idea. And it really depends what you're trying to do. So we have some product ranges like Elements of Isla where we're doing blended malts and you'll have a concept around, for instance, we've just released Fireside and everything around, Campfire, which everything was around being next to the campfire. I basically wrote down what that meant to me. I wrote down s'mores, which was basically because my son and I last November, when we were just on our own in the house, were spending our time burning marshmallows on fire. When you move to Speyside, you become quite obsessed with fire. And then I start, so you have this idea and then you start focusing in on how you can build particular flavors out of that. But I guess it depends. Everything's slightly different, or it is for me anyway. So Tormor, we're seeing at Tormor. I always start with what the spirit character is and what we find in that. So certainly pears, stone fruit, and then look at how we can build around that. You know, what what kind of flavors, what quite often, what kind of food is jumping out at you? So and then how do you build that into a drink? You know, I like to describe Tormor as essentially a peach tart. And then if we're going to tweak it, we're going to try and make it into crumble, make it a bit more unctuous. And then in terms of your question about lead malts and that kind of thing, I guess it's just experience. One thing I do remember Jim Beveridge saying to me when we were doing Sekinder's 50th birthday blend is you always start with thinking you know what's going to work. Then you make loads of trial blends and then you find out that you were wrong. and then you undo it and redo it, and it's inevitably, I mean, sometimes you get very lucky and it's only, you know, 2, 3, 4 different iterations in, but most of the time it's a lot of iterations before you actually find where you want to be.
Okay, so it's a lot of trial and error.
Yeah, also. it's largely luck. Anyone could do it.
Well, I don't know, especially when we think of like those big blends and when they're trying to achieve consistency, I always feel like this is really
consistency
impressive.
Consistency is tough.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we have a couple of things that we bottle, like Podaske Gate Year Old, which is has to have consistency in it. And we have certain ways of doing that. One, it's only one distillate, so that's all from Kalila. We use about 4 different cask types. And we actually have, although we have set ratios for those, it doesn't always work because sometimes the casks are more active or less active. So the way we manage that, apart from obviously going through cask samples, is we kind of create stages of blending. So we'll have a flavor bomb that we create, and then we tone that up and down using refill casks. So there's different methods for doing it.
All right, so quite the science behind it. And a lot of trial and error. No, but now, before we dive into more tasting notes and flavor profiles and so on, let's talk about your role right now a little bit more. And what did it actually feel like once you were just basically handed the keys to Tormor Distillery?
Yeah, so it's definitely an odd experience going from essentially being a whiskey enthusiast slash, you know, part-time shop assistant to having keys to a distillery. I mean, I should stress, although I live here and I have access to the warehouse, which is definitely not a sensible idea. I did tell Polly that when she gave me the keys. It's a stupid idea. It's been quite surreal. It gives us a lot more freedom. We can put into practice a lot of experiments we wanted to do and things that we've theorized for a long time. We can see if they work. Some of them do, some of them don't. But the main thing I found, it's a community. We've got an amazing community here at Tormor. So there's 26 people currently here. We've got an amazing distillery manager who runs the site, Polly. She keeps everyone together, keeps us all in check, particularly me.
Hands out keys.
Hands out key. Well, she hands it. Yeah, I think she regrets it.
Does she?
I'm sure she does now. But it means I've got a great people to work with and ask questions of. You know, if you think about our team here, I've got our production manager Kenny. He's worked across multiple sites with Diageo. So when it comes to distillation and production, you can ask him almost anything. Our assistant production manager Martin, he's worked in warehousing and all sorts of bits of that side of the process. And again, so from like a practical side of things, you can lean into that. And then Polly, you know, outside of running, I can't remember a ridiculous number of distilleries. So from Tomartin through Linkwood through Ben Rinnis, Knockandu, she was also a whiskey maker for Macallan. So when it comes to blending, I've already got someone I can talk to straight away.
So let's look at the distillery. You told us before that Elixir Distillers took over in 2022, and the distillery has been here since 1960. What happened before Elixir Distillers acquired Tormor? So what was going on here before you were here?
So it's had a really interesting history. It was built in 1959 and then officially opened in 1960, but started distillation October 1959. And it was originally owned by Schenley Enterprises as part of Long John. But they were very much making, it was a statement distillery. It was all about making single malt. And the setting, everything about it, when you come here, you can't not stop. One of our major problems living here is the amount of traffic that just slows.
I was about to say, because you can't really stop.
No, it's a really fast road. It's quite dangerous. It is, anyone listening who decides they want to stop, please pull over. So it's quite an imposing place to be. It was then bought by Whitbread, and it became part, like a sister distillery to Laphroaig. They had a single malt on the market, so they were selling single malt by the 1970s, which when you think about a timeline is is pretty amazing. Whitbread were later bought by Allied, and it was part of quite a large group. And I think although there was a single malt available, it did very much kind of disappear into blends. Mm-hmm. It became, you know, you're in that period in the 80s and the 90s where whiskey is down. And but Tormore never stopped producing. It was always producing. And then when it was purchased in 2005 by Chivas, it definitely became part of kind of their main blending malts. It's a big supplier to Ballantine's. But from a staffing point of view, it changed a lot. So we have 13 houses here on site. It was built with 13 houses, all for staff originally. They were sold off in 2004. But we still have guys who work here, who've worked here. I mean, we've got Rod. He's been here, I think, 34 years. His father was here 27 years.
Wow.
So we've got quite a few guys on site. So Westy, I think Westy will retire at some point soon. His father or grandfather built the distillery. So you've got loads of people with all of this kind of background.
Family connections.
Yeah. A lot of legacy. Yeah.
And people used to live here. That was it. They would work here and they'd live on site. That obviously changed. When we purchased it, there were only five operators. So we work 5 days a week, 24/5. And it's five people in a site this big is kind of eerie. I used to come to site quite a bit. We started looking at the site in 2021. So we were here through 2022, certainly from kind of the summer 22, we were on site quite a bit, and you'd come on and it'd be quite quiet. Since we purchased it, there's a lot of change. We're not part of a group, so we don't have the support of, you know, warehouse teams and all the rest. We have to have everything in-house. So we now have 26 people here, which is, it's a massive change. If you come on a weekday, the car park's full. Trying
much
to find
more
space.
Lively.
Yeah, there's yeah. It's really busy. And that's because we've got teams. So we've got a full warehouse team. We've got six people in operation. We've got full team just looking after the building, like putting it back together. So it's a crazy place to be.
So the building, you just mentioned it and we've seen it before. So we said cars are slowing down, and I completely understand, because it's a beautiful building, even though it was built in a time that is not really famous for beautiful buildings. How would you describe the architecture to someone who has not driven by and slowed down?
So it's kind of Art Deco in nature. It's a really interesting building. It was designed by a man named Sir Albert Richardson. He was quite a famous architect for his time. He was known as the Professor. and he was part of what was called the Arts and Crafts movement. So it was all about using local trade, local materials. A big thing about having bringing community into buildings. So that being said, it's massive, right? Mm-hmm. So they designed this massive external building, and then they stuck a distillery in the middle of it.
Yeah, but you said it's not really ideal.
Oh, from a production point of view, no, it's a nightmare. Absolute nightmare. It makes brilliant spirit, but you've got to work hard for it. So we've got an awful lot of steps. If you've got a Fitbit and you want to get your steps in, we're the distillery for you. You can go up and down more stairs here than any other. Everything has to work quite hard, particularly our operators. We've got three separate tun rooms in three different parts of the distillery, all feeding into a still house. And it's hot. Right, it's because it's one giant room with eight stills in it, so it gets really warm really quickly.
All right, so quite the experience then. We just walked around the distillery together with you, and it is definitely unique, and very much worthwhile seeing. But we'll come to that potential possibility later on. Now, from the outside, let's move inside for a moment now. And could you just briefly tell us about your whiskey making process, since you just told us it is actually quite complicated?
Yeah, so we, in, you know, on the face of it, it's a standard single malt process in Scotland. We have a full outer mash tun with three waters, exactly the same as I'm sure many people been around distilleries before will have heard about. We have 11 washbacks, all stainless steel, not temperature controlled, and eight stills, four wash, four spirit, so balanced distillation. So if you say it like that, it sounds perfectly normal.
True.
If you look at things like the way the milling process works, we basically have to move barley in, up, down, around, up and down, eventually for a mill, and then up again. So there's lots of going up and down. Our mashing process today is actually relatively relatively straightforward. We go for a kind of super clear wort here, using our beautiful 1974 full Lauter mash tun. We mash about 10.4 tons. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty big. The way I described, to give you an idea of scale, a good friend of mine runs a distillery in England, and we were chatting last year. We'd had a problem with our mill, and one way or another, we'd lost about 2.5 weeks worth of production. And he said, "Well, you seem really upset about this. It doesn't sound that bad." And I said, "Well, I've already bought all the wood." And he goes, "Well, how much spirit have you lost?" I said, "About 250,000 liters." And he went, "So you've lost our total annual capacity in 2.5 weeks." So Tormore's, we just don't do small.
Yeah.
You know, each distillation is about 5,000 liters, mm-hmm. and we do 17 of them a week.
All right. So that adds up to how much a year?
Roughly with 3.2 to 3.5, depending on how efficient we're all feeling and what breakdowns we have.
All right. But is that all for yourselves currently?
No. So for the last, well, this is year three. So since we purchased it, we provide around 2.5 million liters to Chivas for blends each year.
Ah, all right.
And then the balance we keep, we sell a little bit into other blenders.
And how about the warehouse capacities?
So we hold, roughly speaking, 60,000 casks on site. We when we bought it, it said 72,000, but one of those warehouses was palletized, so we've taken all of that out. So we kind of lost that capacity.
Okay, and then back to the spirit again. Now that you're producing spirit for Chivas, basically, and then the rest is for yourselves, I would assume that Chivas, they would want to have the same spirit they produced before, but you might want to have something different. So are you producing different styles right now?
Yeah, we make a small change when we produce for ourselves. So mm-hmm. for Chivas, we do about 18 mashes a week. For ourselves, we do 17. It just allows us for slightly longer fermentation. We also change up yeast. So we use a slightly older strain of distiller's yeast. From Maori called Pinnacle, and we blend in some ale yeast alongside that, which is quite traditional for Tormore. Tormore was running at least a blend of ale yeast up until 1997. So mm-hmm. it's we were trying to kind of hark back to that, giving ourselves a bit more body. But those are kind of the only real changes we make.
All right, so slight adjustments to make it, well, to produce the spirit to your specifics, basically.
Basically, just to accentuate certain flavors. So we didn't look to change the character. The character of the spirit is indicative of the place. It's actually quite elegant. Mm-hmm. It's very fruit-driven. It's very sweet. We didn't want to change those things. What we did want to do is kind of tone up the, particularly the kind of pears and the stone fruit, really kind of lean into that a bit more and give it a bit more body. Mm-hmm. And we get that as much from, you know, that extra, losing that extra mash, we get a bit more time to rest the stills, which helps us a bit, but it also, just using that ale yeast, gives us a bit more body. Mm-hmm.
But before we jump into tasting notes more and into the whiskey, let's quickly talk about the old stock that you acquired when you got the distillery. So how much of the old stock do you have, and what's the plan with that? And do you think it's good?
Do I think it's good? That's a good question. Yes, I do think a lot of it's good. So we inherited a fair amount of stock. The oldest stock we own is from the very late 70s, mm-hmm. and then mid and early 80s. Mm-hmm. We have some through the 90s, but not a huge amount. And then we have more stock in kind of mid 2000s. We have enough to launch a single malt, and that's our plan, is to build a single malt whiskey for Tormore that you can be proud of. Most of the stock we inherited was in reefer wood. It was it was aimed for blending, so a lot of it was filled at high strength, and it was burnt into older wood. So we started a massive recasking program here. So we re-rack somewhere in the region of 2,500 casks per annum. And that's probably currently looking like a 10-year plan. So it's a big program to do to get us to where we want to be.
And yeah, so we got very lucky today because we had actually the chance to visit the distillery, but it's not open to the public. Any plans to change that?
We hope so one day. it's a beautiful spot, and we have amazing gardens. There's this story that Polly tells, and it's a great example of maybe why we should open, maybe why we shouldn't. She was here on shift on a Saturday. Like, we have to come and check on the weekend, or at least the responsible adults like Polly do. I don't get involved in that. And she was on site, and a young lady from the USA turned up on our doorstep with a van full of people and asked to look around the distillery. She said, I think her exact terms were, I am here for my tour of the distillery. And Polly said to her, well, we're not open to the public. We don't do tours. And she said, well, since when? And Polly very quickly said, since 1959. and the lady said, well, this is just disgraceful. It's such a beautiful building. Why would you have such a beautiful setting and not let people in? And Polly pointed out, well, you know, the staff need a beautiful place too. So sometimes it's nice to think that we'll keep it all to ourselves, but I think eventually we will let people in. The timeline for it, we're genuinely not sure, because we have so much work to do on our site. It's a listed building, so everything takes longer here. And we have loads to do in production. There are bits that need regeneration, so whether that's bits of the stills need to come in and out and the time that takes, some of the tanks we need to replace. And then there's bits we want to change for flexibility for ourselves to make our lives a little bit easier.
Yeah, right. I mean, it makes sense. First, you want to have the distillery up and running properly. And then the next step is to maybe have visitors around. Do you have space to build a visitor center potentially?
Yes and no. There's no space on site really to host people. I mean, you guys had a look around.
I would say you have a very big garden.
We have some really big gardens.
Yeah, but you want to keep it. Like, it's beautiful.
We could do everything in tents out the back. we have quite a lot of space locally, so we own a lot of the woodland around us. So we'll see what we change in the coming years. But in terms of having a really big visitor center, I'm not sure if it's necessarily suits us or suits the distillery. Mm-hmm. There's certainly a lot of places in Speyside you can go to have lunch and whatnot. But it'd be lovely to show people around the site, especially some of the gardens.
Yeah, I totally understand that, because we really enjoyed having a look around and we're really happy we got the chance to do that.
It's so uncommon.
Definitely uncommon, but definitely worth seeing. So now let's talk about the whiskey actually a little bit. And you took over in 2022, and then you started tweaking the spirit that you would want to create, and have changed tiny little bits. It's not actually whiskey yet, what you have produced, right?
No. So we, the first stock that we filled into our wood will turn whiskey at the end of this year. So we started filling into our own wood in October 2022. And the first spirit that we made our changes to was 2023. So there's still another year and 3 or 4 months to go.
All right. But can you maybe still kind of, or already not still, elaborate on the differences in flavor profile when you compare the old spirit that you're also still producing for Chivas and the new one that you have created?
Yeah, so the main difference is probably textural. So aspects, the spirit we're producing at the moment are maybe a little bit fuller. And we've definitely kind of pushed up the esters so that we're getting more of that kind of pear running through it, more of the stone fruit. I think Tormore at its heart, whether it's Chivas produced or when we've been producing it, essentially tastes like peach tea. Mm-hmm. And we're not tried to change that. We've just tried to enhance it.
I mean, it is a very good tasting note, to be honest. But it sounds very much like a light kind of spirit. And that actually has probably its challenges when it comes to putting the spirit into casks, because you don't want it to be overwhelmed by the cask. So what is your wood policy? How do you do it? Do you experiment? Do you take a lot of refill wood, or how would you proceed there?
We always fill a percentage of refill every year. Mm-hmm. And we're lucky because we can control that to some degree through what we're emptying and working with when we're re-racking. In terms of our kind of newer casks and what we're bringing in, we're largely bourbon focused. We fill mm-hmm. a lot of bourbons, vessel bourbons. And then in terms of sherry and other cask types, we fill a lot of American oak sherry. So we still focus again on American oak.
Okay, we use the sweeter kind of oak.
Yeah, very much. I mean, the best way I can describe it is if you write down those kind of stone fruit flavors, you think what you want to put on it is probably custard, right? Mm-hmm. So you're immediately in this kind of world of American oak. We use two or three different coopers out of Spain, who all have slightly different processes, and then working with them, we can use different bodegas for mm-hmm. seasoning. From a wine point of view, we don't do a vast amount in terms of different styles of wine. We use quite a bit of Sauternes where we can, and French oak seems to love our spirit. So French oak is an area that we've kind of, if we're experimenting anywhere, it's where we're looking at French oak. And then lastly, it's new wood. So I've been a big fan of new wood for quite a while. I'm a believer that it's all about how you treat that wood. Mm-hmm. So the toasting methods, charring methods, and how you manage that, and then the strength that you fill into it.
Yes,
so,
right.
You know, we're always trying to get away from those really kind of astringent wood, kind of green wood flavors, pencil shaving. We don't want that.
Yeah.
So we use the strength of the spirit and various toasting methods to avoid that and to get into the compounds that we do want, so the kind of the vanilla, the spices, those things, and extract those. And then I've taken advice from people like Patrick van Zuidam and Bill Lumsden, who have for me spearheaded a lot of the research into whiskey and new wood and how you can develop over not like 6 months or a year, but using it for 10 or 15 or 20 years.
True.
And now the spirit that goes into this wood, you certainly have plans for like shorter maturations and longer maturations. Are you producing exactly, or are you planning to use exactly the same spirit for the shorter and the longer maturations? Because some distilleries use different spirits for that.
So at Tormore, no, we're just going to make one spirit. Mm-hmm. What we do is we mess around with filling strength quite a bit. And mm-hmm. we have various programs in terms of using newer wood or more active wood early on, and then filling to refill, putting that to refill mm-hmm. later on to essentially use oxygen. So we underfill a lot of casks. We use oxygen as our friend. Obviously not from a cost point of view, but from a from a flavor point of view, it's very helpful. But Tormore's not really set up to do lots of spirit types. So mm-hmm. it's quite a, you know, for us, it takes us a week and a half to get to the right character when mm-hmm. we're moving from the style we make for Chivas to the style we make for ourselves. Mm-hmm. So in an ideal world, we'd just make the one style here. Mm-hmm. We're already building one distillery that's designed to do multiple styles all the time, and we'll probably stick that over there.
Speaking about Isla.
Yeah.
So Isla is going to be much more experimental.
I don't like to think of it as experimental, because that makes it sound like you're going to chop and change all the time. But it's designed to make at least four different styles of spirit.
Oh, wow.
Continuously. So it's designed so we can create different flavor groups to blend with, basically.
Okay. Now we have to come back for a podcast episode on Port Natruin.
That almost cries for another episode about Port Natruin. Great, that sounds very, very interesting. But back to Tormore, since Elixir Distillers have taken over, have you already released any whiskies?
So we let a bottling go last year out for Spirit Space. We've not done anything until right now under the mm-hmm. Tormore brand. So we did a small bottling under Whiskey Trail for Spirit of Speyside last year, an eight-year-old, and we've bottled some single malts of Scotland casks here and there. But this is the first year we've released under anything under the brand name Tormore. So we're calling it Blueprint, our pre-release. And it's a little bit about keeping people quiet because people keep asking what we're doing. And we're very quiet about what we've been doing. So it's showing some of the work we've been doing when re-racking to create different flavors. The idea for Blueprint was always to kind of break down the whiskies we're aiming to release in 2026.
Okay.
And yes. Show some of the building blocks of what we're working with.
Oh, very interesting. So you're going to release a very young whiskey then to begin with?
The plan is probably to have a couple of different whiskies, but it doesn't have to be young. We do hold quite a lot of mature stock. Most of what we're playing with is re-racked. It's not, you know, full maturation. We do have some full maturation bourbon. One of the blueprints is something like 75% full maturation festival bourbon, and then it's got some re-racked stock into bourbon as well. Without wanting to say exactly what we're doing next year, we'll probably have at least one aged expression and one non-aged expression to start with.
All right, and that non-aged expression, or well, potentially a no-age statement whiskey in the future, is that going to be a vetting of older stock and newer stock, or would you want to keep those separate?
The recipe at the moment sits somewhere in the kind of 10-year range. The reason for having it non-aged is so we can have the flex to go a bit younger if we want to, or go a bit older. The idea is to try and get consistency. So we've got something on the shelves that everyone can drink. And one of the things we're really keen on is to have it as a drinking whiskey, not as a kind of showpiece or as a collectible. We are all at our heart drinkers. So it's really important to us that we're putting stuff in a bottle that people want to drink rather than keep.
All right. Sounds great. And does that also mean that you're going to set up kind of a core range and go less into the single cask kind of direction? Or what does that mean for the future?
Yeah, very much so. So, you know, one Tormore was we're a big distillery. So don't get me wrong. I'm sure there will be specials in many years to come. There's everyone does that, and when people come to distilleries, they want to try something a bit different. But no, the focus is actually on consistency. The focus is on making something that people can drink every day, and it has flavors that you expect every day.
Mm-hmm. So is there already a plan of what that core range might potentially look like? Or do you have numbers in mind, or
maybe
is that nothing you can talk about right now?
There are recipes. It's not that... it's not complete, so I feel like to talk about it in any detail, if I then change it, that would be wrong. but no, there's already recipes being worked on. Okay. The whiskey's probably ahead of the packaging at this point, so pretty sure we know where we're going to be releasing next year, and pretty sure what the age ranges will be.
Yeah,
but it would be wrong for me to share it right now.
No, that's all right. But still, one more thing about the packaging. Just please keep it simple. Don't make it too fancy. It's just like all those fancy rebrandings happening right now. We love our traditional
packs.
Bottles.
Yeah, look, all I care about is that it fits on the shelf. the shop assistant to me just remembers unpacking bottles that didn't fit on shelves, and it really wound me up. So.
And now, not looking at the short term and Martin asking for all the bottlings that are going to come out, but...
Sorry.
What is your and Sukhinder Singh's vision on Tormore for the next, like, let's say, 5, 10, 15 years?
Well, essentially, our vision is to build a single malt that is approachable and that people can drink all the time. So, and it sounds daft, but today, so many whiskies are about being big, oily, heavy things that are obviously really interesting. We're not saying that Tormore isn't interesting, but we just want it to be something that you want to pick up a second glass of. So maybe something a little bit easier. Does that make sense?
So success would be Tormore being on the shelves and accessible for everyone and nice and drinkable for
success would be
to enjoy.
Yes, success would be Tormore being poured by people. Absolutely. That's what we see. We are desperate to share what we make here. with as many people as possible.
Well, yeah. As passionate as you are, I'm pretty confident this is going to work out.
Well, I hope so. I've never been the positive one in the business. That's always been Sikinder's role.
It has been quite successful, so don't change. you probably know that we always end our podcast episodes with three quick questions.
I do,
so,
yeah.
And Martin. We're already there, yeah.
Yeah, we're already That's there. It.
So we're going back to our initial topic, football. If you had to compare your perfect idea of a whiskey to a football player, who would it be and why?
Well, if I'm specifically thinking about Tormore, then it's Gary Lineker. I want precision, quick, and I want to score lots of goals, particularly against Germany.
Come on. All
right. Okay.
Gary Lineker, take that one.
So I'm not asking any football questions.
So, and by the way, you can hear he's from England. He's not he's not from Scotland.
No.
Anyway, you've worn many hats in the whiskey world, so you've been through all the roles basically. If you could just keep one of those hats, like doing this one job for the rest of your life, which one would it be?
Oh well, this one. This one being probably the blending side, the making. I love the creativity that we're allowed, mm-hmm. And I love the research. I enjoy coming up with very silly ideas that sometimes work, and having the freedom to have a go at it. So yeah, I think that this side of the business is the most fun. I don't think I'd go back to talking to people again. I wasn't great at it.
What did you say? Was it that you hated cleaning?
Oh, I hate it. So, I mean, to be fair, I put myself in that position. That was not hardly a job. I spent a week working with a friend in England at a distillery to learn process when I was doing my IBD. And the first job I had was cleaning out a mash tun. That was terrible. Yeah, I wouldn't recommend that to anyone. But I would highly recommend having keys to a warehouse and being able to go get samples. And
I would
stuff.
Highly recommend that as well. Now, last question. If your son grows up to work in whiskey one day, you said whiskey played an important role in your entire family, basically. What's the one lesson you'd want to pass on?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think there's a very generic answer, which is be happy. I think the biggest lesson is people. The one thing I've been immensely lucky in my entire career is working with really great people. From working at the Whiskey Exchange in the early days with the guys in the shop, Alex and Chris and Duncan, to Billy Abbott, who's one of my dearest friends, and of course Sikinder and his brother Rajbir. I'm very lucky with the people I've been surrounded with, and now at Tormore it's the same. We've got such an amazing team, from distilling through to warehousing, who care so much. Mm. So I guess the lesson to my son is really care about the people, look after the people, because they're the ones that make it worthwhile.
I think we cannot finish on a better note than being the people.
Sounds just about
making
perfect,
this industry special. So thank you very much for being on the podcast, for showing us around also.
Yeah, thank you so much for taking the time.
For giving us the opportunity to see Tormore. And if you want to get to know more about Tormore Distillery, visit their website under elixirdistillers.com and follow them on social media at elixirdistillers. We are Miriam and Martin, and this was Inside Whiskey with Oliver Chilton of Elixir Distillers and Tormore Distillery. Thank you, Oliver.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us on the Barrel Talk today. If you enjoyed this episode, tune in again next time for some more tales about the water of life. And in the meantime, follow us on Instagram at @inside_whiskey, on Facebook at Inside Whiskey, The Barrel Talk, or visit our website on insidewhiskey.de. This was Inside Whiskey, The Barrel Talk. We'll be right back.